Well, good morning, Saints. We're going to carry on today with our study in the life of David. And I love the Bible because it shows the heights. Last time we looked at how David was able to show mercy towards Saul when he actually didn't deserve it. When he had him in his hand, but he chose grace and he shows mercy. So the Bible declares the victories that the saints have, but also the lapses of faith, the times of unbelief, the times when we wander a little bit away from God's calling unto us. And I love it about that it shows us warts and all, our strengths and our weaknesses. Last time we looked at the strengths of faith in the life of David, and carrying on from where we left off, Samuel dies, and David again, then he goes into an incident with Nabal and Abigail, and how he was able to show grace and mercy to Saul, but he was going to wipe out Nabal and all his household, and if it wasn't for the righteousness of Abigail that withheld his hand, he would have committed that deed. But he ends up taking Abigail as his wife, and then he spares Saul again. So we get to chapter 27, and this is one of the lapses in the life of David. He has many victories, but this is one of the lapses in his life. And so chapter 27, verse 1, now David said in his heart, now I shall perish someday by the hand of Saul. There is nothing better for me that I should speedily escape to the land of the Philistines, and Saul despair of me to seek me any more in any part of Israel, so I shall escape out of his hand. Then David arose and went over with 600 men who were with him, and with him to Aish, the son of the king of Gath. So David dwelt with Aish in Gath, he and his men, each man with his household, and David with his two wives, Ahinoam the Jezreelitess and Abigail the Carmelitess, Nabal's widow. And it was told Saul that David had fled to Gath, so he sought him no more. So straight away we're introduced into this chapter in chapter 27. Then David said in his heart, now I shall perish someday by the hand of Saul. Are these the words of faith? Are these the words of trust and belief in God's plans and purposes for him? No, they're not. David said in his heart, I shall perish someday. He's looking at things completely from a horizontal perspective at the circumstances that he's facing. There's no account here of God's promises to him, his faithfulness so far in delivering him. David says this in his heart. It's the natural man. It's the natural heart. Jeremiah says that the heart of man, in chapter 31, I think it is, the heart of man is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. And this is what the natural man is actually like. This is our heart, apart from the Lord Jesus Christ. It can deceive us as to God's will for us, his promises to us. It can look at circumstances and forget all about God's faithfulness. The natural man's heart is full of unbelief. And David is saying to himself here, I shall perish someday by the hand of Saul. God had promised David that he would sit on the throne, that he was to be king, that he would take care of him. So David's having a little lapse in his faith. Excuse me, I'm just recovering from that worldwide coronavirus thing. He's saying this to himself, that Saul is going to get me. I need to do something here. And he's going to move himself from the position in the land of Israel to the enemies of God. He's tired of the running, all the time that he'd been going from cave to cave, with, and he's now got about 600 men with him. He's got their wives, he's got their children. So he's got a lot of responsibility upon him, because he's going to have to provide for all of these people. He's tired of the pressure, and he concludes within his own natural heart that maybe life with the enemy is actually easier. I just need a little sojourn. I need a little break from the pressure and the continual running from Saul. But all of this he's saying as a natural man. He's not taking God into account one little bit. And I love the Bible, how it shows these things, because we are no different. We have times of victory. We have times of trust. We have times of faith. But we also have lapses in our faith, just as David did. Times when unbelief rules, and we let, and God isn't even in the picture. We don't even take him into account. We just look at things from a natural perspective and forget all about God's providential care for us as his children. But just as David has had two of these, this is the second time he's gone to the Philistine and Gath. They were the enemies of God. He's gone there twice before. Once before, and this will be the second time. Just like David did, we find these same weaknesses in many saints in the Bible. And Abraham is one example. Have a look in Genesis chapter 12. Because now Abraham is the father of faith, the friend of God, someone that believed God when there was no reason to. But he still had weaknesses. He still had times when his faith actually departed, and he lied. Just as the same, when Abraham was in his flesh, he didn't believe God, and lying came with it. And David, it's actually the same. So in chapter 12 of Genesis, in verse 10, now there was a famine in the land, and Abraham went down to Egypt to dwell there, for the famine was severe in the land. And it came to pass, when he was close to entering Egypt, that he said to Sarai his wife, "Indeed, I know that you are a woman of beautiful countenance. Therefore it will happen, when the Egyptians see you, that they will say, 'This is his wife,' and they will kill you. But they will kill me, but they will let you live. Please say you are my sister, that it may be well with me for your sake, that I may live because of you." So it was when Abraham came into Egypt that the Egyptians saw the woman, that she was very beautiful. And the princes of Pharaoh also saw her and commended her to Pharaoh, and the woman was taken to Pharaoh's house. And he treated Abraham well for her sake, for he had sheep, oxen, male donkeys, female servants, male and female donkeys and camels. But the Lord plagued Pharaoh and his house with great plagues because of Sarah, Abraham's wife. And Pharaoh called Abraham and said, "What is this that you have done to me? Why did you not tell me that she was your wife? Why did you say, 'She is my sister'? I might have taken her as my wife. Now therefore, here is your wife. Take her and go your way." And Pharaoh commanded his men concerning him, and they sent him away with his wife and all that he had. So the picture you've got is Abraham is on his journey from Mesopotamia into the Promised Land. He gets into the Promised Land where God has called him, but there's a famine. Is it possible that God can call you to some place and that there would still be no rain and still no food? Well, yes, it is possible. Does that mean that God wants you to go elsewhere and look? Well, no. But Abraham, his first instinct was to go back to Egypt. Egypt in the Bible always typifies, it's always figurative of the world. Like Isaiah 31, "Woe to those who go down to Egypt for help." Israel was delivered out of Egypt, picturing the world crossing through the Red Sea, the death and resurrection of the Lord Jesus Christ, into the wilderness and then into the Promised Land. So it's being brought out of the place of Egypt to where God is actually calling us to. Israel, when they were when they were living in unbelief in the wilderness. They were always desiring, hunkering back for the food and the things of Egypt, the things that they liked, the things that they tasted. So Egypt always pictures for us a going back to the things of the world, or going back to what we once served. But Abraham in this passage, he's afraid. He's afraid that his life is going to be taken, so he lies. But God, in his providential care, made sure that Abraham was okay, that Pharaoh didn't touch Sarai. But we see that when a man steps out of trust in God, then the flesh and whatever little things that we have, for Abraham, he had an issue with lying. There's no doubt about it. The scriptures show it to be so. Because in Genesis to chapter 20, this is something like 30 years later in his walk with God, and you've got exactly the same situation and the same weakness. So Abraham, in verse 1 of chapter 20, Abraham journeyed from there to the south, and he dwelt in Kadesh and Shur and stayed at Gerar. Now Abraham said of Sarah his wife, "She is my sister." And Abimelech, king of Gerar, sent and took Sarah. So he's journeyed to this Gerar, lied about who his wife is again. But God came to Abimelech in a dream by night and said to him, "Indeed, you are a dead man because of this woman whom you have taken, for she is a man's wife." But Abimelech had not come near her, and he said, "Lord, will you slay a righteous nation also? Did he not say to me, 'She is my sister'? And she, even she herself, said, 'He is my brother.'" So both of them were lying. "In the integrity of my heart and the innocence of my hands, I have done this." And God said to him in a dream, "Yes, I know that you did this in the integrity of your heart. For I also withheld you from sinning against me. Therefore, I did not let you touch her." So you got the same scenario. Abraham makes the decision to journey back into a land, and he's forced to lie about his wife again the second time. Same situation, same weakness. He's gone round the mountain. 30 years later, you'd think that with all his walking by faith with God delivering him from one situation after another, that things may be a little bit different. But saints, this is what the flesh is like. It is unchanging. After 30 years, you'd think that he may be a little bit better. He may trust. But this is exactly what we are like. The flesh does not get any better. It doesn't improve. It doesn't it doesn't get any better whatsoever. It is what it is. The only thing that it is actually good for is crucifixion. Doesn't get any better. 30 years later, he does exactly the same thing as when he just started his walk with God. He is now a 30-year believer in God's promises, in God's ways, in God's protection, but you see him acting in exactly the same way. Doesn't get any better. But we see in verse 6 and 7 that the one, even though Abraham is showing no faith whatsoever, he's faithless. In this instance in his life, God is still active. The sovereignty of God is still there. And God said to this guy, "I know that you're innocent, you know, and I know you have integrity, but I also kept you from sinning against me. Therefore, I did not let you touch her. Now, therefore, restore the man's wife, for he is a prophet, and he will pray for you, and you shall live. But if you do not restore her, know that you shall surely die, you and all who are yours." So God actually reveals to Abimelech that this man whom he's got is the prophet. He's his person. He's his servant. He's his mouthpiece. He is a prophet of mine. And you could imagine from Ahimelech saying, "What? This guy here? This guy that's just deceived me, this guy that's nearly had my life taken from me, this guy that's nearly brought judgment down upon me, I was completely innocent. This man, he's going to pray for me and things are going to be blessed again in my house. this man, this is your man, this is your prophet? And God will say, yes, he is mine. Even though he's acting in weakness and his flesh is evident, this prophet is mine. He's mine. So the outcome of it is that Abraham, and Abraham even shows it in verse 11, and Abraham said, or Ahimelech in verse 10 says to Abraham, what did you have in view that you've done this thing? In other words, that you lied about who your wife was, and I took her and nearly lay with her. Why would you do that? And Abraham said, because I thought surely the fear of God is not in this place, and they will kill me on account of my wife. So in other words, he's looking at things completely from a natural point of view. He's not taking God into account whatsoever. God was sovereignly working behind the whole scenes and stopped Ahimelech from acting in this way, but Abraham didn't have to lie to even put Sarah in that position. So the outcome of it, in verse 17, so Abraham prayed to God, and God healed him, Abimelech, his wife, his female servants, and they all bore children, for the Lord had closed up all the wombs of the house of Abimelech because of Sarah, Abraham's wife. So I've brought Abraham in here because he's got the same weaknesses that David has. David also was a man of great faith, but he also was a man like us. He had lapses in his faith, and when he lapsed in his faith, he lied, just like Abraham did. Yes, it's true that Sarai was his half-sister, but it's a white lie. It's a half-truth, and he's only saying it because he's actually not trusting in God wholeheartedly for this situation. But David, he lied as well. You remember when he fled Saul and he came to the priest Ahimelech, he lied to him about why he was there. He said that Saul has sent me on an errand, and he had the food and he got Goliath's sword. But the outcome of that, because he wasn't completely honest, the priest didn't know what his intentions were, what was going on, and Saul entered into that place and killed him and 85 other priests, all because of what David had done. The first time that he fled into the Philistine land of the king of Gath, we see David, when he was afraid that this guy wouldn't accept him, we see him scratching at the doorposts of the gate and letting saliva run down his beard, and he acts like a madman. This is God's chosen king. Could you believe that he would actually behave in such a way? He's pretending and acting to be someone that he actually isn't. And we see here also in chapter 27 of 1 Samuel that when he takes himself out of the land and into the enemy's hand and into their land, that he actually starts to lie again to this, lie and deceive this king of Gath. So the question remains, how does he get here? How can David and how can us be walking by faith one day, and then we have these lapses where we're going to leave the land of blessing and go back or go into the enemy's territory? How did he get here? Now, we're all the same. And when I was thinking about this, why is it that we wander? Why is it that we stray so quickly? Why is it that we find ourselves on a different path in a different area? And it reminded me of Pilgrim's Progress. So I want to read to you just a little couple of pages out of Pilgrim's Progress. Now, I saw in my dream that they had not travelled far until the river, and the way parted for a time, at which they were very disappointed. This is the journey of Christian and hopeful on their way to the heavenly city, the celestial city. The path away from the river was rough, and their feet were tender because of their travels, so they grew impatient on the way. Now, doesn't that remind you? This is what David is actually going through. He's been hunted by Saul. He's had lots of testings, lots of trials. The path that he was walking on wasn't an easy path. It was rough, just like Christian and hopeful on their way. So as they continued on, therefore they wished for a better road, A short distance in front of them was a meadow, and on the left-hand side of the road there was a set of steps constructed over the fence bordering the meadow, which is called Bypath Meadow. So in other words, it's another road and another track that you can walk on. And Christian said to his friend, "If this meadow lies alongside our pathway, let's go over into it." Then he went to the steps to see, and sure enough, a path lay along the way that they were going on the other side of the fence. "It's just as I had hoped," said Christian. "Here is the easiest going. Come on, Hopeful, let's go over and walk on this path." "But what if the path should lead us out of the way?" asked Hopeful. "That's not likely," said Christian. "Look, doesn't it go along next to the other path?" So being persuaded by his friend, Hopeful followed him over the steps, and after they had gone over and had gotten into the path, they found that it was really easy for their feet. And with that, looking ahead of them, they saw another man walking, and as they did, they asked him his name, and his name was Vain Confidence. So they called after him and asked him where that path led, and he said, "This path goes to the Celestial Gate also." "Look," said Christian, "didn't I tell you so? By this you may see that we're right." So they followed, and he walked in front of them, but night time came and it grew very dark, so that those who were behind lost sight of him who was in front. But he was in front, that's Vain Confidence. Not seeing the way before him, he fell into a deep pit that was put there on purpose by the owner of that property to catch conceited fools. And with that, he was dashed in pieces by his fall. Christian and his friend heard him fall, so they called out to know what the problem was, but there was no answer. They just heard groaning. Then Hopeful asked, "Where are we now?" And his friend was silent, considering whether he'd led him out of the way, and now it began to rain, and there was thunder, and they were having a terrible time. There was lightning, and the water rose with such force. Then Hopeful groaned in himself, saying, "Oh, if only I'd kept myself on the narrow way." And Krishna said, "Who would have thought that this path would have led us out of the way?" "I was afraid of it at the very beginning," responded Hopeful, "and therefore I gave you that gentle warning. I would have spoken plainer, but you're older than I." "Dear brother," said Christian, "don't be angry. I'm sorry that I brought you out of the way, and that I've put you into such imminent danger. Please forgive me, brother." Now this little story, that what goes on and on and on. They were going on the track that they were on, but it was actually difficult. It was the way to the Celestial City, but it was rough going. Just like David has had a rough patch in his life, all the time running from Saul, they saw another track, right next to the other one, and it looked like it was easy. Bypath Meadow. There is always a bypath meadow for us saints. It's always running. In fact, when you look at Proverbs chapter 8, it talks about wisdom lies at the crossroads where the paths meet. There is always different paths, and wisdom lies there and cries out to all who are willing to hear. Now the Christian and Hopeful, they see this other path and they think that that's going to be easy, that that's going to take them to the Celestial City. But what happens to them is they end up heading into danger, and then they end up heading into a land by where they get captured by a giant Despond, who locks them up in his castle and beats them up, and they have to get released further on down the track. But how did they get there? They saw a path that was easy to travel on, so they took it. They took themselves off the rough one, which was the path, the narrow way, and they jumped over. And it's exactly the same for us. We're exactly the same. Sometimes we just want a little break from the things that we're going through. God seems to be silent, or there just doesn't seem to be any hope, and we see another path or another way, or we think life back in the enemy's camp will actually be easier. This is what David is saying. He's going to live over with the Philistines, the enemies of Israel, thinking that he'll have a break from the pressure that Saul is putting on him. So in saying that, we're all prone to these things. Turn to the book of Hebrews and have a look at the warning, a warning there in Hebrews that I thought about when I was looking at this. Hebrews chapter 2. There's actually five warnings given in the book of Hebrews to the hearers of the good news of the centrality of Christ. And the first one is actually given in chapter 2, and he says, therefore, we must give the more earnest heed to the things we have heard, lest we drift away. For if the word spoken through angels proved steadfast, and every transgression and disobedience received a just reward, how shall we escape if we neglect so great a salvation, which at the first began to be spoken by the Lord, and who was confirmed to us by those who heard him? So the first warning in chapter 1 is about we need to take notice about the things that we have heard. We need to give them more earnest heed, lest we drift away. Drifting is as easy to do as breathing. Drifting is so easy to do. Just like seeing another track like Christian and Hopeful. Oh, this one looks nice. Let's go on this one. That's what a drift is. Now, I love my fishing. Fish as much as I can. I've been out many times. And one thing about fishing that, like, I've got marks. I go out and I find my spot and I'll line up. I've got boundary marks, say like a marker in the harbour with a house in some area or a dip in the mountain range or something like that. So you've got marks that you always set your boat at. So you'll anchor your boat according to those marks. And you can be fishing away and not realising all the time that your anchor is slipping. And because you're not looking at those fixed marks that you have all the time, you don't realise that your anchor is drifting. It's scraping along the bottom. It's not actually firm. And you'll drift, drift, drift. And there can be other boats around. And if you're not paying careful attention, you're just watching your lines and pulling in fish and rebaiting and looking at everything else. But before you know it, you can be drifting right into the path of another boat's anchor or where they're fishing. And it's happened to me quite a few times. So the only way to actually not move is to be continually fixing your eyes upon your marks, continually looking at those things by which where you wanted to park in the first place. And it's exactly the same with our Christian life. We're all prone to drifting. And we all drift at times. And the only reason that we drift is because we take our eyes off our boundary markers, which is the centrality of Christ. We look away from the things, we look away from his death, we look away from his resurrection, we look away from him having his right to actually choose the things in our life. Christians are always drifting. And it's only because we take our eyes off. Like Hebrews here says, therefore we must give the more earnest heed to the things we have heard, lest we drift away. In other words, we have to pay attention to the things that we are continually being taught. We need to pay attention to how much we are spending our time in the Word. We need to pay attention to how much we are conversing with God. See, most Christians drift away slowly. It's never really a sudden departure. It's always a slow drift. And all you have to do to drift is actually nothing. Do nothing. Don't pay attention. Don't pay attention to the Word. Don't pay attention to the things that God is prompting you to do. Think a good example of this, of someone that drifts, would be Samson. We've covered his life when we did the book of Judges, but it wasn't a sudden departure from God for Samson. It was slowly, little bit by little bit, little bit by little bit, little compromises here, there, little bit, little bit, little bit. And before he knew it, he had drifted so far that when his strength, his locks were actually cut from his head, one of the saddest Bible passages ever, that he didn't know that the Lord had departed from him. One of the saddest verses in the Bible. That's how far he had drifted, that he actually had no idea of the presence of God actually even departing. He was so detached from God at that point in his life that he didn't even know that God had left him. So it's all you have to do with drifting is actually do nothing. Do absolutely nothing. I read an example once of a man that in his will, he gave his farm to the devil. Now, I don't know why he gave his farm to the devil, whether he was all alone, he had no wife to give it to, no children to give it to, but in his will, he actually gave his farm to the devil. And the judge, he didn't really know what to do, so he decided the best way to carry out his wishes was to allow the farm to grow weeds, allow all the soil to erode, to let the house and the barn just rot, in other words, pay no attention to whatsoever. So in other words, he said, well, if I'm going to give this farm to the devil, as this man's wishes are, the only way I can actually do that is actually to do nothing and allow the whole place to deteriorate and allow all the buildings to ruin. And that's all I can do. And apparently that's what happened. But it's exactly the same with us saints. We never drift suddenly. It's always slowly. And we need to, as the Hebrews says here, we need to give earnest heed. We need to pay full attention. We need to focus on the things that God has said. This is why Philippians says we need to work out your salvation with fear and trembling. You've had a great salvation and you need to work that out in your life. You need to set your heart on things above. Colossians 3 tells us where Christ is seated and we are actually, our lives are hid with Christ in God there. Drifting. All you need to do is to do nothing and you'll drift. Now David, he's drifted. In 1 Samuel 27, he said, I shall perish someday by the hand of Saul. It's better for me that I live with the enemies of God. He's drifted. He spends 14 months over in that land. That's quite a long period of time. Have you spent 14 months drifting? Some people spend years and years and years. Most of us, it's just short periods. But some people spend years. I know someone that was 20 years. He was a full-on Christian, used to evangelize everything, be out on the streets talking to people of God, and then he just drifted. And then he was 20 years gone. But then when he came back, he was back, just like that. But 20 years wasted, drifting. And he would tell you that. I wasted 20 years. David here, 14 months. He doesn't write any psalms. There's no spiritual songs that he writes over in this place. So while he's over there, he starts lying and deceiving to the king. What David ends up doing in chapter 27 is he ends up going on these raiding parties and attacking certain groups, and wiping out everyone, men, women, and children, so nobody could bring news back to this king about what he was doing. He would say that he was fighting in the south, and he would be going a different direction, wiping out the Amalekites and people like that. But he was gaining this man's confidence in a deceitful way. He even gets into chapter 29, and you see that he joins with the Philistine army, and the Philistines are going to go to war with Israel. They're going to go and fight. After 14 months, he had gained so much favor with the king of Gath that he's enrolled in the Philistine army. How on earth could this be? How could the servant of God find himself enrolled in the enemy's army, potentially going to go and fight against Saul and God's chosen nation? How can this be? How can you find the servant of God that far gone? It would be like us joining ISIS or something, or a group like that, and find ourselves at the rear of their army, going to fight against Jewish or going to fight against the Jews or Christians or something like that. It's crazy. David finds himself at the rear of the army, and thankfully, probably through the providence of God, in chapter 29 of verse 4, but the princes of the Philistines were angry with him, and the princes of the Philistines said to him, "Make this fellow return, that he may go back to the place from which you have appointed for him, and do not let him go down with us to battle, lest in the battle he become our adversary. For with what could he reconcile himself to his master, if not with the heads of these men? Is this not David, of whom they sang to one another in dances, saying, 'Saul has slain his thousands, and David his tens of thousands'?" So then Achish called David and said to him, "Surely as the Lord lives, you have been upright in your going out and coming in with me, and the army is good in my sight. For to this day I have not found evil in you since the day of your coming to me. Nevertheless, the Lord's do not favour you. Therefore return now and go in peace, that you may not displease the lords of the Philistines." Yeah, it's incredible. And David actually responds, "Well, what have I done?" In other words, he was prepared to actually be at the rear of their army going to war against Israel. Thankfully, you probably got the hand of God in behind that. I don't know what would have happened had he have actually got to the battle and find himself fighting against Saul and the armies of Israel. But this is a crazy scenario, and hopefully this is the hand of God behind it all, that he didn't allow David to go so far that he's in that position. So the outcome of all of this is that he's 14 months over there, and he finds himself gone this far. And David, God has to take David out to the woodshed, really, and give him a little dealing. And that'll be the next message that we do, because trouble comes to David and his fighting men and all of their families. And it's these events that actually bring him back to God. But how can these things be? It's incredible. This is a big drift. So David knew many things about God. He knew his shepherd care. If you think about Psalm 23, we'll finish on this. If you think about Psalm 23, David knew these things to be true. "The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want." Now, right at the start of Psalm 27, there's no mention of God. All he can see is that life with the enemy may be easier, may be better. It doesn't even mention God's shepherd care. "He makes me to lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside the still waters." David knew these things to be true, and so do we. But when we are not, when we are not walking in faith, then our flesh just dominates. And with whatever weaknesses you have in the flesh, that's what'll rule. "He restores my soul. He leads me in the paths of righteousness for his name's sake. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death," which David had been doing, "I will fear no evil, for you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me." The rod and the staff. See, David knew all these things to be true. He was walking through really troublesome times, having to run all the time from Saul. He'd been walking through that valley. He knew that the Lord was his shepherd, and he says, "For you are with me." He knew that at one point, that no matter what he faces, God was with him. "Your rod," which was used for correction, "and your staff," which was used for guidance, "they comfort me." Now the staff had a little loop on the end, and the shepherd used to, when they had a wandering sheep all the time, he would reach that out and put it round the neck and pull it in, drag it in closer, keep them close. That's the shepherd's crook. And even though David is, he knew that to be true when he was walking by faith, he's going to come under the rod and the staff for a bit of correction that's coming his way, because he's drifted. You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil. My cup runs over. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. What a beautiful, beautiful psalm. And you can actually take every one of those verses as an individual message. But here today, I just wanted to finish on that, because David knew that to be true. But he's drifted. And none of those things in that psalm he can relate to now, because he's sort of put God to one side. And he said in his heart, I think life with the enemy might be a little bit easier for a time. 14 months he spent over there. And when he was over there, we see him deceiving the king and lying to the king, and finding himself at the rear of the Philistine army. How can this be for a man who's to be the king of Israel? He's already been anointed. He's already had the confirmation of the promise set over him. But in the same way that he can fail and drift, Abraham, he failed and drifted, we are the same. We're the same, saints. We drift at times, and it's because we lose attention. We lose our eyes, move off the boundaries of the Word of God. They move off the centrality of Christ, and they just work in a horizontal way as to what we're facing at the time, instead of a vertical way, and exposing each and every new situation unto the Lord for Him and His business to actually deal with. Let us not be like Christian and hopeful that see an easier path, or like David did, maybe life with the enemy is actually easier. But let us stay on the narrow path, even though it may be rough at times and hard going. It is the only path that is heading toward the celestial city. So next time we'll look at what happens, because David's been taken out to the woodshed and he's got a smack coming, but it brings him back to God. So I pray that you've seen something else in the word here today, and that it may be a blessing to you all. God bless.